Bonjour and welcome to Beyond Sports
with Hampus and David.
This marks the first international edition of our podcast due to our guest today
being from Denmark, and I have very hard time understanding Danish people speaking, so we're gonna do this in English.
Emil Berggren, he's a football player playing in Twente in Holland. Well,
I have a question for you. Do you have any perception about Danish football players?
Just that they like the perception you have about Danish handball players, that they drink a lot of beer after each game. And of course, I would say that Niklas Bentner has influenced the way we look upon Danish football players.
Yeah, and I was in Aalborg due to the last episode we had with Mikael Agerfors in Aalborg. Mm-hmm. And we were out going for a walk. And this Danish football club were out practicing. And each one of them had like 6 beers in their hands and a football under their arm.
Oh yeah, there you go. So should we just do like this, that we turn the background, jazzy background music on, and we go into your presentation of Emil.
Emil Berggren is a Danish football player. He's 26 years old and has a Croatian mom. His professional career began in the outskirts of Copenhagen, and more precisely, Brunshøj BK. He went on playing for Brunshøj BK until 2014. And in the summer of that year, Emil signed a contract with Team Hobro, a contract he wouldn't fulfill due to offer from the Zweite Bundesliga club Eintracht Braunschweig, who signed him. Just a year later, he signed with the Bundesliga club Mainz 05. Unfortunately, he got injured just a month after his arrival at Mainz and had to undergo a knee surgery. He was back from the injury in the summer of 2016. And if that wasn't bad luck enough, just a few weeks back from rehab, Emil got a new injury in his knee. So in 2017, he still hadn't made his debut for Mainz yet. After all of this, he decided to leave all the bad luck in Germany and move to the Netherlands, and is currently a striker for FC Twente. And one last thing you didn't know about our guest today. There are two kinds of people in this world. The ones who put milk in the cereal bowl first and then add cereal. And there's also the kind of people who should be locked up in a straitjacket who puts cereal in first and then adds milk. Like they don't care at all that the cereal will get soggy and lose all their crunch. Emil is unfortunately the later one of these two kinds. With that said, welcome to Beyond Sports, first episode in what we in Sweden call Svengelska. Welcome once again, Emil Berggren.
Thank you, David. Thank you.
What did you think?
Well, you're right. I am one of the latter regarding the cereal. So guilty as charged. I also liked your presentation of my career. Some minor gaps, but...
Please tell me.
Yeah, okay. Okay, when I went from Braunschweig to Mainz, I was actually already injured. So it didn't happen a month after, and they knew I was injured when they bought me. We had other hopes than what reality ended up being. So we thought I would be fit quicker, which didn't happen. And other than that, you were pretty precise. I think I would have liked it if you also mentioned that I actually did come back and play for Mainz, because otherwise it would just be... total bullshit period in my career, which it was, but actually I did come out on top before I then went to Twente.
So how many games did you do for Mainz?
I think I played 14 games.
Okay, so we will probably come back to this period, but should we maybe take this from the start? When did you feel that your football career really started to take off, and why would you say that it did?
Well, so when I was young, I was a good player. I was always one of the better players in the team. But then I had some years where it went down a bit, and my development stalled. But thankfully, my body didn't. As I went from being very, very small and tiny to become tall and strong. And in these years where I was growing a lot, I was not one of the best anymore of in my age. And that's,
what age is this?
Oh yeah, when I was maybe 16 to 18, I was a late grower. So I became very tall, and I had maybe a few years where I struggled with injuries, and my bones were growing faster than my muscles, and my coordination was not the best in these few years. But when I came to Brøndshøj, I was starting out at the second tier of Danish football, and I had a good period there, broke through, scored some goals, went to Hobro just 6 months after I went again to Germany. And at this point, I felt, okay, anything is possible. I can go from playing in the Danish second league to play anywhere, and no one's going to stop me. So these 2 years where I went from second division in Denmark to Bundesliga, this is where I felt, okay, I can do anything.
And how old are you? Is that in the beginning of your 20s or...?
Yes, I was 21 when I went to Germany.
Can I just ask you a quick question about that? Is it easy to get caught up in the hype about that, going from the second league in Denmark to going to Germany? Or how do you stay grounded? Did you stay grounded?
Yeah, I definitely stayed grounded. I think it's probably a bit easier if you have that good run when you are a little bit older. I think it's tougher for those guys who are really, really hyped when they are extremely young, like maybe those who are the biggest talents when they are 16, already playing in a first league club, getting a contract with Nike or Adidas when you're young. And so I think it helped me to be a little older when I broke through. So with 19, 20, 21, there you're better prepared than if you're 16.
So your period in Germany, then what was it that really made you improve as a player? Did you feel that there was a difference?
Yeah, there was a difference, a big difference in the tempo of the game. Already in Braunschweig, in the second league, I felt that it was much, much quicker than the first league in Denmark. So I improved just by training, and of course in the games, it was playing under more pressure in front of a bigger crowd. We had always 25,000 to our games, and that's unusual in Denmark. I know you have actually a good culture in Swedish football, but we don't in Danish football. So, and then when I went to the first league again, it was a bit higher tempo, but I was out for 2 years before I actually started playing, and it was no problem to adjust. Okay. I think,
about those 2 years of when you were out, we recently in this podcast talked about long-term injuries and how that affects players and what kind of help they get from the staff. Did you get any like psychological help from there, or were you all alone in that part and just had to do the rehab when you should?
Yeah, so it was tough. I don't think there is a right answer about how to handle it when a player is out for that long. So if they did anything right, no, I don't think they did. I think I could have had more support, but
in what way?
Yeah, for my specific case, I came and I was injured and I didn't get fit and I didn't play a game before I got the big injury, the ACL injury. So I hadn't even played a game for the club yet. So, you know, when you didn't play yet, you don't really have a status in the dressing room, and you just feel like you're some kind of foreigner, which you are, but even more when you can't play, because then you can't prove yourself on the pitch and you are there to play. So, but I think I had some good physios outside of the club, actually, at a rehab facility that tried to help me with anything, paperwork, insurance matters and all that. And it was actually more like the physios from the rehab center that that took care of me and helped me in this period.
Okay. Did you talk to the coach anything during this time? Or of course you talked to him, but about your role and how you would adapt?
No, I didn't. I said in an interview just after my comeback when I scored in my debut against Freiburg that the coach had supported me and had spoken to me throughout my terrible time. But this was not true. This was to to protect him, maybe, because they asked the questions. Because honestly, he just said hi to me in my time as a rehab player.
Okay. So what was the reason, do you think, that he didn't like talk to you and support you as much as he could have or at all?
He came in as a new coach, first time that he had a big job, and I think he was just over his head trying to keep this job and trying to do good. And at the bottom of his list was obviously keeping a long-term injured player happy. So I didn't expect a lot, and they didn't give me a lot, so it added up.
So, but what did you do to keep your head above the surface then?
I would say this first 6 months that David described, where I was in Mainz and was injured and then got injured again, those were the hardest ones because I didn't know what was wrong. I didn't know what to do. And then I tried to train and instantly got the ACL injury in my first training. And then it was, of course, a big blow, and I was down and I needed a surgery. But from there, it kind of could only go one way, and that was up. So it was as soon as I had a plan that, okay, I had a surgery, reconstructed my ACL, then I knew there's a timeline and I can look at this table and see, okay, am I doing well? Am I in front or not? And then it became easier to keep my head up. But I used my friends and family. It was always nice when someone came to visit me. At the time in Mainz, there were some other Danish players, Nicky Simling. And I was a lot in his house, eating, having nice dinners with him and his wife and lovely family. She cooks a lot better than me. So that helped me a lot in this period.
Yeah, it seems like that's an important thing to have, somewhere to bounce back. I would like to take it, you talked about being sort of an outcast in the locker room when you came there and were injured. Could you see any differences between being a player in Denmark and internationally? Because in Sweden, I can see that when a new player comes to team, everybody tries to make that player feel at home and get into the group. But we also talked to guests here who said that when they went to play internationally, they got the attitude of like, you're here to take my job, get the fuck out of here.
Yeah, I recognize that, definitely. When I first went abroad and came to Eintracht Braunschweig, it was like that. You know, I came into the dressing room expecting a warm welcome and didn't really have it. It is not meant in a bad way, because it's just how it was. You know, they greeted me and said hello or guten Tag. It was only in German in Braunschweig, and I didn't speak German at the time, so there was nothing to really talk about. And I was kind of in shock about, okay, are they not doing more to make me feel welcome? But then I just understood that, okay, it's part of the game. And they had a great team manager who helped with everything. So the staff did their best to help me. But in the locker room, you had to prove yourself on the pitch before you weren't recognized as anything. And then again, in Mainz, I was a little bit in the middle of the groups, I think, because at that time I knew some German and I'm from Scandinavia, so they would expect me to manage in German and manage most things myself, like the post. But I didn't have a clue when I got a long letter in German, or I wasn't that good, you know. And the French guys, African guys, and the Latino group, they had a translator and I didn't have any help. I was clearly disappointed with what Mainz did for me outside of the pitch, but in Braunschweig it was fine.
So if you were some kind of player's manager in Mainz when your career is over, what would you do when there's a new player arriving?
First, I would hire another team manager because there was nothing wrong with our team manager in Mainz. Darius is still his name, and but he just had too many tasks, too much responsibility, mm-hmm. like organizing training camps and this and that, and even involved in some transfers, talking with agents, I also think. So I would hire someone who's just there to help the players with the basic stuff because they need it.
How come you changed to Twente after this? What was the process there?
I came back strong and had a good run in Mainz, but then I had some issues again with my knee. I had an injection and had an infection in the lower leg where they had to remove the screws of my old surgery. And after this, I was out a long time again. And kind of again, I was disappointed by the lack of support from the club. And after that, it was there was only one option for the both of us. It was to part ways.
Okay. And how do you go about to do? Do you have a manager or agent you talk to?
Yes, I have.
Set up? I would like to go play in Portugal. What do you talk about? How do you talk about it?
Yeah, we talk like that. But of course, when you want to change club after being injured for a long time, you are not the one who can call the shots. So you have to look at, okay, in my case, I'm a big striker, so it's a very sought after type of player. So it's not too hard to find me a club when you have proven you can score goals at the highest level. And when you have my size, it's you're always going to find a club. But yeah, you're probably not going to find the club you want after being out for that long. I would like to try play in the south somewhere, maybe in Spain, to meet a new culture after being in Germany, where it's cold for nearly 5 years. I would like to try and go play in Spain or England, but I could see I got a lot of offers from Belgium and Holland and a little lower leagues, and okay, I need a step before I can go where I want to go, so that's why I went to Twente.
Did your agent and you reason about this? Did you feel that he wanted the best for you, or do you have like a long-term plan together with your agent?
So I think it's difficult to make a long-term plan because you never know what's going to happen. I think our long-term plan was that I should score a lot of goals in Mainz and go from there to a top club. So it didn't happen. I had my injuries and we have to deal with a new situation. And then we adjust the plan. So, but I think for me and my style, our long-term plan would be that I do well enough to play in England.
Okay, so that is that your like your dream to play in a good club in England, or?
Yeah. Yes.
I also heard that you got some offers from like Asia and Japanese clubs. Is that right?
No, not offers, more like interest and talk. And I haven't been interested in going there yet. So I had an offer from the eastern part of Turkey that was really a financial good offer that I considered a little bit, but in the end, I was not too keen on moving to the border of Iran at this moment.
Oh, okay, I see.
We actually had a guest a couple of weeks ago who played football in Turkey, and he was talking about his paycheck not arriving at time, so to say. Is this something you have to have in consideration when you're thinking about going to a new club?
First, I have to consider if my geography is off. Is Iran even next to Turkey on the map, or is it actually Syria? I apologize if I offended someone there. But yeah, of course, especially if it's if you come with an injury history to a club in a country where there is tradition for not paying wages if something were to happen to you and you got injured again and they don't pay you, then you are, of course, in a bad spot. You have to look into where you're going, and Turkey is one of those places where there is a lot of history with the players not getting paid, and then it doesn't really matter that if you have a good contract if you don't get the money.
So if we're at 20 now, how do you feel about your football career and your life there? What is the sentiment right now for you?
I like to be here. I like Holland a lot after nearly 5 years in Germany, it's nice to try a new country, and the Dutch people are really on wavelength with me and with other Scandinavians, I think. So I enjoy it here as a person, and on the pitch I am really not happy that I haven't played the last few games, so I hope to change that. But generally I'm happy to be here because it's a good club, we have great fans, and a good big stadium, so it's always nice when you have good fans.
What do you mean by what is the difference then between German culture and Netherlands culture then?
Okay, so first of all, in Germany, for example, it's a rather big country with a strong economy, and they have a understanding that they are like the center of Europe, and some of them even the center of the world. And that means when you come to Germany, everyone, they're not, maybe not in the bigger cities, but if you're in a small city, they would expect you to take their culture in completely, like only speak German, and because you are now in Germany. And in Holland, it's a small country, like a smaller country like Denmark, so they are more welcoming towards foreigners, and they enjoy to speak English and to help people who are not from there. So that's the first thing that I think of.
Are there a lot of different nationalities? More different nationalities in Twente than it was in Mainz, or because Mainz had a few South American and African players as well, right?
Yeah, but we have a lot of Spanish guys here in Mainz, and our coach is from Uruguay. So we also have a Latino group here that reminds me of the group we had in Mainz with the South Americans and the Italians and the Spanish guys. So we don't have any Africans here, but it's also multicultural. But we speak English. The coach speaks English, and in Mainz we also had a Japanese player, and you know, all these guys who didn't speak German, they had a translator with them on the pitch, even, and for every meeting and for the training camp, we had maybe 8 rooms filled with translators. Where in Holland, it's just, okay, we do it in English, so that's nice, easy for us.
In Danish, is it called pest or cholera? Do you know this plague or cholera?
Yes.
Yes, okay. But I think in English, it is called would you rather. I don't know, David, if you want to take it in Swedish, Swenglish, or English. But Emil, are you on to a little game of Would You Rather?
Yeah, sure.
It's 10 questions. Question number 1. Would you rather eat feces that tasted like brownie, or would you rather eat brownie that tasted like feces?
Brownies that tasted like feces.
Yeah. Would you sit on a pre-body heated toilet seat, or would you prefer to sit on a room temperature toilet seat?
Room temperature.
Would you prefer to go to sleep with the one you love but never wake up together, or never go to sleep with the one you love but always wake up together?
the first one, to go to sleep together and never, yeah, for sure.
Okay, question number 4. Would you like pubical hair as teeth, or would you like teeth as pubical hair?
I don't know. Okay, the first one.
Would you have a backpack on the belly, or your belly on the back?
A backpack on my belly.
Yeah. Okay, you could only buy and wear secondhand clothes, or let your mom pick out clothes for you for the rest of your life.
Okay, this is a good one. I would wear secondhand clothes then. You can still get some good ones. Then no offense to my mom, but yeah.
She has great taste in clothing otherwise?
She has, yes, but...
Would you skip ahead 5 years and get 5 million or skip ahead 10 years and get 50 million?
Which currency are we talking?
Euros.
Okay, then five years is enough.
That's enough. Okay, for no reason, beat up a five-year-old kid, or for no reason, walk by a person in a wheelchair and say, it's not that fun to be in a wheelchair all the time, but it has to be a bit comfortable to be able to sit down now and then.
the second one, for sure. Yeah, they like, you know, people in a wheelchair, they are often overly protected, so I think they like to
hear the truth.
If someone actually makes some rough jokes, and so I think they are not that vulnerable as you may think.
No, you're doing them a favor. Okay, never drink another beer in your life, or never have another taste of red meat again.
I have to sacrifice the beer then.
Yeah. Okay, the last question. Christiania or Red Light District?
I have to say Red Light District. I think it's more fun to walk there than Christiania, maybe, though both are good options.
Would you say Christiania is like a tourist trap?
I don't know. I have never been that tourist, so I'm not the right one to ask, but I have been at Red Light District, and it's really an experience to walk by there. And there are lots of people, families, and so it's fun to see that it's actually no one's judged there. You know, it's just families and all kinds of people walking by, looking at the girls in the windows. It's pretty fun.
Yeah.
What about the girls in the windows? You feel no empathy there?
No, I don't, because I know that it's the only country, Holland, maybe, I don't know if it's the only, but I know that they are proud of that they have a union, a workers' union for the prostitutes, and so they are not supposed to be forced to be there, and they have medical access and can earn a lot of money on it, so I think it's up to them.
Last week we had a guest, Mikael Agefors, who is a goalkeeper, Hammer goalkeeper in Aalborg, and we talked about the differences in liberality between Swedish and Danish people. Would you say that Swedish people are stiff?
Yes.
Why is that?
I played with a couple of Swedish players, and they were actually all kind of the same style, where they were a little bit more private than I would expect, given that we are neighbors. Mm-hmm. And they had their kind of their own style, which I also admire a bit, because it's easy to come into a German environment and try to be like them, but you know, to keep yourself on the way under pressure. What do you mean
by that?
I mean, for example, when I came to Braunschweig, it was a cultural shock for me, because I was used to playing in Denmark, where you can talk about everything. If the coach said something in training, you can ask him, what did you mean by that after, and he will take his time to speak to you. And in Denmark, you can even call the queen by her first name, you know. And in Germany, or at least in Braunschweig, the coach demanded to be called Herr Trainer, or by his last name. You couldn't call him Thorsten, and you had to say "see" instead of "du." And yeah, this was for me stupid and weird, but I had to deal with it and try to be extremely polite and formal all the time. And yeah, it's not really my style. So then you give up a bit of yourself to fit in, and that's sometimes what you have to do. But I like the people who don't do it, actually.
Okay. And who was it? Josef Buffo, no? Who played in Braunschweig?
Yeah, so first I played with Lucas Olander in Braunschweig, and then I remember, of course, Joe Buffo in Braunschweig, and Robin Quaison in Mainz.
Did you miss Pierre Bengtsson in Mainz?
And Pierre Bengtsson? No, I was with him, but I was injured at the time.
Oh.
But again, he was, you know, we even had the same agent, and I knew he had been in Denmark for many years, so I would expect to be greeted with a big hug when I came in the dressing room by him, and we would have a lot, but he didn't really speak to me a lot in the beginning, and then after a while, okay, we found each other. It wasn't like that with the Norwegian players I played with. I instantly found some chemistry with them. Okay. But that's, again, I can't say, because it's just my personal experience.
Yeah, no, but I think there is something in it. And
yeah, like Robin Quaison in Mainz. We lived right next to each other. His apartment was in the same building on top of mine. And I was in it maybe once or twice in 3 years, huh? And same the other way around. But we were cool with each other. We had a lot of respect for each other and found a good relation, but it was just not like that we hung out a lot. So
One would think that it would be an easy thing to just, okay, come to my place, we will have dinner and play FIFA, or the other way around. But that wasn't the case.
No, it wasn't the case.
Okay. And why do you think this was?
Okay, of course, one factor is that you are together a lot at the club, you know. If you have two training sessions, you have to be there 1.5 hour before training. And in Mainz, they even had a box where you had to put your phone and it would be locked in with a time lock until half an hour after training. So if you are at the club the whole day, you had nothing else to do to them to be with your teammates. That's all good, but then okay, when the day is off, you need something else, you know.
What do you think about that? We talked earlier as well about cell phones in teams. What are your stance on cell phones and locker rooms and locking it up or having them?
I think locking them up is ridiculous. So then you don't really feel like a man with his own authority, because okay, the coach says I'm gonna lock up my phone, then I have to do it. But did it help us as a team that we didn't have the phones? I don't really think so. But I like it that you have some kind of rules about it, so maybe no pictures in the dressing room. And but for example, the dressing room, I think it should be allowed because it's the player's own space. So when you're on the pitch, when you're in the gym, when you're everywhere, okay, it's not allowed, or shouldn't be allowed. But the dressing room, you are there so much. So especially the people with families, they should be allowed to text their wife or something, you know.
I get the feeling that the locker room is something sacred, or they want to give that feeling at least.
Could it be something I think it should be. And I think those coaches who fail to make the players feel like their dressing room is sacred, they fail as a coach on that area.
It feels like the German stereotype is coming to live here and coming to show. is it like a big difference coming to Twente then with a more a relaxed environment throughout the whole team and with the coach and all that, or is it that obvious as it seems?
Yeah, it is for sure. Also, we have a rule that if you know, we in Mainz we had a long list, and I think in any German club a long list with fines. If you fuck up, then you have to pay a big fine, and they are expensive. You know, it's. I have seen fines up to 15,000 euros for players who did something wrong. And it was not a short list, you know. There are a lot of rules. And in Twente, we have one rule that you shouldn't come too late, you know. And if you come too late, then you have to either bake a cake or sing in front of the whole group.
Oh, yeah.
Have you been late?
No, I haven't been, because I have been in Germany for so long, where the consequences were far, far more serious. So I have it under my skin that you don't come late for practice.
On a deeper level, I would say that a lot of football players, they had so much restriction and no responsibility within their freedom. So when they stop playing, they get a lot of freedom, and that's when they lose themselves, because all their life they've been like, okay, you have to be here at this time, and when you come here, everything will be set for you. And when they stop playing, nothing is set for them, and they have no time to be on time to.
Yeah, for sure. It's interesting. I think you're right.
Have you started to think about what will happen after your career, or in what way are you dealing with this?
Yeah, for sure. I think, of course, you learn a lot as a footballer when you go abroad and you meet different cultures, and maybe when you finish your career, you master more languages than the usual Danish guy, you know. So I hope that my career will give me some skills that I can use in another career. But I had the idea that, okay, when I finish playing, I will study something. But I don't think I will, because if I'm 35 or whatever, and I have to start studying and find the books and for 5 years or 4 years or something like that, it's going to be too long, too boring. I'm going to be 40 before I get finished and started with something. I want to start a career when I finish this one, and I don't know in what business, maybe in football, because it's such a big part of your life that you know a lot of people here. So.
So what is stopping you from studying or getting a degree of some kind?
Right now, while I'm playing?
Yeah.
First of all, I don't know what I want to read, if I should educate myself right now. And I think we train twice a day, almost every day. So if I knew after training that I had to go home and deal with some homework, I wouldn't enjoy life as a lot.
Have you ever had an identity crisis, if we're talking about getting a degree or start playing football due to an injury? Have you ever had an identity crisis?
It sounds very strong, I think, identity crisis, but I know what you're getting at, because of course when you're a football player and then you're injured for 2 years, so that means you don't play football no more. It's like being being a real estate agent who didn't sell a house for 2 years, then he will probably not feel so good about himself, you know. And I have felt that how much better you feel with yourself when you are back playing, you know. It doesn't matter if you have success or not in the moment, just by being there on the pitch, fighting with defenders and doing your thing, what you like to do, it makes you feel better with anything. So yeah, I think you know, those people I spoke with who ended their career and who had a long career in at the highest level in Bundesliga or Premier League, so they rarely miss it, because it has also been rough on their bodies and rough on their minds and on their they had limited freedom. So most people I speak with are like, oh, okay, when I finish my career, I thought maybe I would miss it. But for the first 5 years, I don't think you will miss it.
And like you say, that you need to find something to do and something to be passionate about, I would say.
Yeah.
It's in football or somewhere else.
I think it's very rare that a player is playing at the highest level just because of his talent, because it's not enough anymore. So you need also to be able to work hard and have a drive. And if you have that, then you need to find something to do where you can use that drive for some other good than playing football.
When you look back on your life, Emil, what would you like to see that you had accomplished?
I think if I look at it in a bigger picture, it would be a good accomplishment to, you know, to have a good group of friends and to have a good relationship with your family. If you have started a family and built a house, and those are great accomplishments, you know, So if you are good on those, then finding your way after your career is going to be easier, I think.
Yeah, I don't strike you as a person who finds meaning in a lot of making a lot of money, but where do you find meaning outside of football?
That's a good question. I like to be with friends and I like to have fun. I love the Danish, the Scandinavian kind of rough humor, and if I have a good night with some friends where we take the piss on each other a lot, sorry for cursing, then I am very happy. Then I feel like I'm in my right element. So that makes a lot of sense to me. The most the dumbest nights with friends can be the most meaningful for me.
Yeah.
Do you feel that you can be that person in Holland now, for example, with the guys in the team?
Yeah. There? Yeah, I actually feel I can more than I could in Germany. I can, so that's nice.
We talked about meaning and how it is to become a football player, but what is your life's biggest turning point or crossroad where your life went one way but could have gone a completely different direction?
Well, so it was always about football for me, so even when it didn't look that good with injuries and so, I never thought about doing anything else. So I would have to say probably when I went from the German second league to the first league, because at that moment I could also have gone somewhere else. Maybe I could have gone to England so that would have been a turning point. And then of course, when you have a big injury that will affect you, the way you prepare for training and the way you need to be extra professional for the rest of your career and life, maybe that's also a turning point. Because then you don't just take football for granted anymore. You know that, okay, it's not forever and I have to get the most out of it while I'm at it.
Do you regret going to Mainz or do you have anything that you regret doing in your life?
Yes, I regret going to Mainz. But again, at the moment it felt like the right thing, so that's why I did it. So, you know, it's not like I sit up at night saying, oh, I should have done that or that. You know, you always have a reason for the things you do when you do it. And then you can always look back and say, I should have done something else. But it's not wise to think like that, because of course, if you know, you take your decisions based upon how you feel when you have to take the decision, and that's why I don't have actually any regrets about that.
You regret it, but you don't have any regrets.
Yes,
taking the decision.
Exactly. Because if the world was different, if I could change things, I would probably change that, but I can't. And at the moment, it was the right thing. So, yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
And that's kind of funny as well, because when you ask people who've been through some rough time and you ask them if they would have, if they got the option to be without that experience, they almost always say no. They would have went through the experience, even though it was very rough, because it's taken them places they are now. And you said one wise thing about it's hard to give advice to other people than yourself, but if you could give an advice to an aspiring football player at a young age, what would that be?
How young?
Maybe he's just getting an offer from playing abroad.
Okay.
Some people is telling him to stay in Denmark to play a couple of years, get established in the Danish league, or some people, his friends, telling him to go.
Yeah, I would tell him to go, get out there, because you got to get out there and test yourself and take the steps. So if you have an offer abroad and it feels a little unsafe and you would maybe rather stay at home and one more year, then you will get a better offer. You never know, you know, and you can also get injured. So when you have the offer, get going, and if you want to go, and your agent or your father or anyone tells you it's better to stay, then remember it's still your own decision, you know. Mm-hmm. And then just when you are going taking the steps and approaching a higher and a higher level, you will come under pressure, and you will have to sometimes play when you are a little bit injured, and they will pressure you to take an injection and to play on pills. And again, here you have to stand up for yourself. If it doesn't feel right, don't do it. But and sometimes do it, because again, if you don't play that game, then you will lose your place. It's not easy to be a footballer. But listen to yourself, because if you really think, oh, I have a problem here with my groin or with something, and the physios at the club say, it's okay, nothing can happen, and trust me, something can happen. They hope it won't, but it can happen, you know. So you gotta trust yourself, and you will come under pressure again and again and again. And of course, if you give into it, they will see it, and they will always do it to you. But if they see, oh, this is a guy who stands up for himself, then hopefully they will let you do that.
If you were on death row, only having a couple of hours left to live, and you got to choose your last dinner, what would this be?
I'm in between. I really like good sushi, so that would be an option. But I think, you know, at some good restaurants, you can have that actually as a starter, and then you can have a steak after. So I think I would, if I can swing it, I would do it like that.
Mm-hmm. What is a good sushi to you?
I like basic sushi with salmon and avocado, and it doesn't need to be too exotic for me, but I like uromaki, I think. Mm-hmm. It's called basic uromaki. If it's good quality, there's nothing better.
For me, I like sushi a lot, but David, you also told me when you were in New York one time that you had the best sushi of your life there. Yep. I have a hard time visualizing what is a really, really good sushi that is like the best of your life.
First off, the rice has to be lukewarm. Mm-hmm. This cold rice is that's no good. And then in Sweden we have this, instead of having like pölsevagn, we have like sushis all over the place, and all the sushis are the same, with a cold ass rice, salmon from the Baltic Sea, and a lot of wasabi. And the sushi I had in New York had minimal of wasabi and pure taste of the fish. Okay. I don't get that with Swedish or Danish sushi. But I would say if you get a rice that's lukewarm, it's a good sushi.
Is this today's djungelknep?
Yeah, I recognize what David is saying. If it's too much about the extras and the spices or the sauces, then it's no good for me. I like the taste of good fish, but I think you can find that in Denmark. I haven't tried in Sweden though, but you definitely can find it in Copenhagen.
I would be interested to know, because in Sweden, and I don't know how it is in Denmark, but in Sweden you barely get your sushi at a cost of extreme amount of money, and then you get your own body weights in pickled ginger. How cheap is that pickled ginger? Do you get a lot of pickled ginger in Denmark as well when you order sushi?
I think you get I don't know if you get a lot. I like it. So
do you know how to eat sushi like properly? Could you describe it?
Okay, the first rule is you eat it with sticks and not with a fork. And then if you can handle the sticks, then you are pretty much a long way.
Yeah, I've seen this. Have you seen the documentary Jiro Dreams of Sushi?
No.
Oh, this is for you, Emil.
Yes, okay. This is Djungelknep. It's a great documentary about the best sushi place in the world, allegedly. And he says that you shouldn't have wasabi in the soy sauce.
Ah, okay, I fucked that one.
And no ginger. The ginger is just between bites, just to get rid of the taste from the previous sushi.
Ah, okay.
And actually, a little bonus tip: when you grab the sushi with the sticks, and you have salmon on, you shouldn't get the salmon in the top of your mouth. You should turn it around so the rice hits the top of your mouth.
That is a great tip.
Yeah.
Okay.
So you get the salmon on the taste buds.
Yes, exactly.
Okay, yeah. You know, it's my style of eating sushi has worked for me many times. So, but I will try out your advice and see if it can improve
next
my
time.
Experience.
Next time you eat sushi, turn it around, turn it upside down. I definitely will.
Okay.
When was the last time you were sad or mad? And what emotion comes to you first?
It was Thursday last week. I was, I don't know, maybe a mix between sad and mad.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How did you? Why were you sad or mad or both?
Because we had a tough training session where we first had a gym session, then we did a running test, and after that we played a position game, and after that we played a game, like a game against ourselves, and mixed with some under 21 players, so it was 11v11, and it was a really, really tough day on the office, and I think I worked a lot to do a good pressure, because that was one of the focus points of the training, but our coach didn't seem to agree that I that I did a lot. So yeah, that's a bad feeling when you feel, okay, I'm doing an effort here to work hard, and if it's not recognized
what did he do? Did he talk to you like constructively, or did he yell at you?
No, he's not yelling. He's a great guy. He would never just yell, but he was unhappy with the way we pressed in the first half of this test game. You know, that wasn't the best feeling when I felt I was making an effort.
You were talking about pressure on the practice. We have a question that we ask every guest on our show, and that's, how do you stand on peeing in the locker room shower?
I do it.
You do it. Do you have any fines if you do it, or?
No, it's Holland. You can do it.
Were there fines in Germany for this?
In Braunschweig, it was a serious matter. In Mainz, there were no fines against it. But you can do it with respect. You know, if someone is standing right there where the water is going out in this, I don't know what to call it, but then don't pee so it will hit his feet, you know, but make sure you pee with respect, then it's fair enough.
We have had some hockey players on this show, and they do this thing called a pee bomb in the shower. Do you know what that is?
I am familiar with that.
Okay. It's Danish, goddamn.
Yeah. I didn't know that it was that international.
I know about the concept.
Will we be seeing you in England or Spain after your time in Twente?
I love the weather in Spain, and I also like the people. They always they are often smiling and in a good mood. So it would be nice. And in England, I think that it's quite rainy, and I had a lot of rain in my life. But they are also nice people with a great sense of humor, which I appreciate. So it would both would be good. I think England is more likely.
And if we should be a little bit judgmental here, English people isn't they're not all models, and you're very good looking, Emil.
Thank you. Yeah, So yeah. What are you getting at?
I'm getting at you should focus at football and maybe go to Spain. Then you can take siestas.
Yeah, that would be good, wouldn't it?
Do you have if you had a genie in a bottle, a specific club you could go to in Spain or England?
I always was a fan of Newcastle when I was young, so that's it's not quite London, but and then my teammate from my colleague in Mainz was also a striker. He actually went there, so kind of jealous on that one. Muto, the Japanese guy with the translator. In Spain, I would like to go somewhere with a beach, you know, somewhere alongside the coast. So it's not that I would turn down Madrid, but I would prefer to be on the coast.
Is there a specific reason that you're not mentioning France? Have you maybe heard something from relatives or stuff like that?
Yeah, I have a far-out relative, my sister, whose man is playing in handball in France with you, Hampus. So I heard a lot about France. I wouldn't say that I wouldn't go to France, but it's not the first country that pops up in my mind. It's maybe in my top five, but not up there as Spain.
Should we be rounding this up? David, do you have anything else that you want
to... Yeah, I have. I don't know if you know, Emil, but I work as a teacher. And when my student has a test, I always write on the last page, is there anything else that you know about the subject I'm testing you on? Please write it here. So they can write something that they feel like, okay, I studied to this for this, that they didn't miss out. Is there anything that you want to add that we haven't asked?
I think it's a good way of treating your students, because then they actually can get it out if they have something. No, I think you had some good questions. I don't know what to add at this moment.
We have a final question, then we will end. If you had, after this talk, you have to call somebody and say that you're sorry, who would that call be to?
Oh, that I'm sorry.
Yeah.
This is again a tough question, really tough one. It takes more self-reflection than I have, because I can't, I don't know who to call. Maybe my mom, because it's not, she does a lot always, you know, and maybe she deserves to be recognized a bit more. I don't know. I could call her, try that one out.
That sounds like a nice thing. Yeah, with that said, super grateful that you came on the show with us, Emil.
Yeah, thank you for the invite.
Thank you very much.